strangest thing is that this is today just about the freest period in American history, minus the last 2 years. We were a little bit freer before Bush came in. The people in office want to make it worse. The job now, of course, is to stop them from doing so.
Iraqis are only asking for the basic things that any human being is asking for. They are asking for security and electricity. Is that too much for a human being to ask for in the 21st century?
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, September 22nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A car bomber killed an Iraqi policeman and himself outside the UN headquarters in Baghdad today, a month after a deadly bombing there. The attack, which came as the United Nations considers expanding its role in Iraq, also injured 19 people, including two Iraqi UN workers. The blast occurred at the entrance to a parking lot next to the UN compound at the Canal Hotel, scene of a devastating car bombing last month that killed about 20 people, including the UN's top envoy. Secretary General Kofi Annan warned that if the situation continued to deteriorate, UN operations in Iraq will be handicapped considerably. "I am shocked and distressed," he said, "by this latest attack on our premises in Baghdad. We are assessing the situation to determine what happened, who did it, and taking further measures to protect our installations," Annan said. Today's blast took place one day before President Bush is to address the UN General Assembly. Bush is expected to offer the UN an expanded role in rebuilding Iraq, a precondition set by many nations for contributing peacekeepers and money to the reconstruction effort. Annan has made clear he wants assurances of security for UN personnel in Baghdad, along with any expanded role. The interrogations of September 11th mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed portray an al-Qaeda terror network that is fluid in its planning, willing to go slowly to achieve spectacular results, and determined to carry out plots even when initially thwarted. Along the way, terrorist volunteers are shifted between different attack plots based on opportunity, according to interrogation reports reviewed by the Associated Press today. For instance, Mohammed told his captors that when two of the four original operatives assigned by Osama bin Laden to the September 11th plot failed to get U.S. visas because they were Yemenis, bin Laden simply changed course and asked the two to study the possibility of hijacking planes in Asia. Their mission in East Asia was to, he said, fly commercial airliners to gain familiarity with how jets operated in that region, Mohammed told questioners in one report. Bin Laden then came up with additional participants for the September 11th plan, offering a member of his personal security detail as well as a large group of young Saudi men who ultimately made it onto the ill-fated jetliners. Mohammed is quoted as saying in the interrogation reports. One of the first U.S. soldiers to die in Iraq, Jose Gutierrez, was an orphan Guatemalan who at the time of his death was not even an American citizen. As U.S. casualties in Iraq continue to mount, so does the worry in the country's Latino community that its children are dying in unusually high numbers and are being lured into dangerous service with targeted recruiting by the armed forces. Many in the community worry that Latino men and women are being disproportionately exposed to risk and set on the front lines. According to the Pew Hispanic Center, while Latinos make up 9.5% of the actively enlisted forces, they are overrepresented in the categories that get the most dangerous assignments, infantry, gun crews, and seamanship, and make up over 17.5% of the front lines. The U.S.-led occupation authority in Iraq has ordered the overhaul of Iraq's economy and instituted free market reforms that will permit foreign ownership of every sector in Iraq. The announcement was made by the interim Iraqi finance minister on Sunday at the meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank taking place in Dubai. Issam al-Khafaji, a former member of the U.S.-run Iraqi Reconstruction and Development Council, is in Dubai. He spoke with Peace Watch today, and we asked him how the privatization of Iraq's services and industries, as well as opening Iraq to foreign investment, would affect the people of Iraq.
I raised two objections to this, actually. One is constitutional. If we are talking about a transition, change of government from dictatorship and tyranny to democracy, then such big, very big decisions, very radical decisions that will have effects and consequences on the lives, maybe to the better or to the worse, on the lives of millions of Iraqis, and changing the entire economic and social system, you have to respect the legitimacy. First, it's not a law, it should be a decree, because we are still talking about an interim government. Second, you have to wait for an elected government and an elected parliament that could pass or may not pass such a decision. Now, that's the constitutional and more worrying aspect. If we begin the transition to democracy, the post-tyranny, with this kind of decisions, then I can't see what claim do we have to democracy.
Mm.
The second one is about the socioeconomic effects. You know, the point is no longer about capitalism or not capitalism. The point is, what kind of capitalism do we want? Do we need the foreign investors? We certainly need them. The point is how and why. And we are not discovering the wheel. I mean, we are coming after 3-4 decades of the sweeping privatizations everywhere in the world. And I have always alarmed, and I do alarm myself and my countrymen, and anyone who would like to listen, that it's Iraq is very much susceptible to the kind of transition towards mafia sort of capitalism that the world would suffer, and Iraqi certainly would, because we are talking about such sweeping privatization. We haven't yet found yet the net worth of the ex-regime, who were billionaires, the third and fourth layers, whom the media do not look at, and the and they are not high-profile politicians. How can we guarantee that these people, with their networks, cannot turn into traffickers in drugs, in weapons of mass destruction, in prostitution, in what, and you name it? These are people who have the political machine. I'm not saying only those people. I'm adding to them some people who might come from the ex-opposition or people who have been and the private sector outside. So such shock moves are not always recommended. Mm. As the tragic event of Russia and during the Yeltsin era have shown. The point is not only this. I mean, I have been, even now, over the past month when I left Iraq, I am in daily contact with Iraqis, businessmen, bankers, industrialists, merchants, and naturally non-business people. They are all terrified by this. Do we really need to encourage capital? Are we really in the process of encouraging healthy, productive capitalism? Or do we want to send all the productive capacity, the Iraqi productive capacity, outwards, out of Iraq, including those highly experts, high experts whom you were warning the world against, and rightly so, that we have scientists and people of high technical expertise. The point is this, that businessmen themselves are independent and honest businessmen are terrified with this, that this kind of sweeping and shocking competition, imagine a modest Iraqi bank with $1 million capital competing with J.P. Morgan, or imagine an industrialist competing with General Motors immediately after the end of this tyranny. I mean, this is just non-conducive to any healthy revival of a private sector, a productive private sector-based economy.
What infrastructure do you feel needs to be in place for something like this to happen and to work effectively?
We are not inventing the wheel. The Koreans, the Taiwanese, many other countries, the Indians now, there are so many experiments. What I would like to see is opening up the industrial sector, for example, And what I would like to think of is finding jobs for the 60-plus percent unemployment rate. And then you can go into the banks. Look, in 1997, some 40 years after the takeoff of the so-called tigers, the Asian tigers of Asia, many people, including the most influential institutions, the World Bank, etc., admitted that the reasons for the crisis in 1997, the financial and economic crisis, was, and I'm quoting, the too early opening up the financial sectors of these economies. And when was that? In 1997, after 40 years after these countries have reached a real degree of maturity in their capital structures. Now we are beginning with opening up our financial sector. What incentive could any industrialist have in Iraq to invest in industry when he or she can put his or her money in any kind of a J.P. Morgan or whatever bank and just sit idle and wait for their profits? Then we will have to wait in 10 and maybe much less than that, in 3, 4, 5 years' time. Why are these extremists, where are these extremists are coming from? They would be coming from those people who would be much more marginalized, laid off outside the labor market and any chances of finding a decent life. And this how the cycle of and an unpredictable consequence can come from.
Mm. Let me just suggest to you that one of the proposed changes is a reduction of the income tax from 45% to 15% as the highest rate. Now, previously, Saddam Hussein did not enforce the collection of taxes. And on the face of it, it seems like perhaps that would be a good idea. But in an economy where, as you've pointed out, most people are still unemployed, what impact will this have?
Well, modestly speaking, I have a first-hand account on the audit system in Iraq, the financial system, thanks to my staying there, being in close contacts with the administration and my previous contacts before going back to Iraq. Look, the only impact, it will be on those who earn wages and salaries, whether you lower that from 45% to 30% or to whatever, because without a real audit system, which we do not have, and that's why we in Iraq Revenue Watch are calling on the World Bank and the IMF to impose their transparency and accountability systems and to help us in establishing a taxation system that's efficient. Before that, all the burden will go on the salaried and the wage earners, because I know from first-hand accounts how big businesses can, and even medium business, can hide their earnings, because there's no way now with the prevailing chaos that you can monitor what their earnings are. If and only if we have a real auditing system, we have a real control system, we really know what is going on and out of this country. This is what I am advocating. We have to first to establish a rule of law, and then let's discuss it in a constitutional way under a real elected government. Let's discuss what is the optimum income tax that should be applied to this or that industry, to this or that activity, to this or that level of income.
One could argue that opening Iraq to foreign investment before security for the Iraqi people is restored could be a misplacement of priorities. What's your opinion of that?
Exactly. This is just something that I really am amazed at. I mean, the people who are professing these statements, they have been in contact and in touch with the outside world. They are not the miserable, poor Iraqis who have been locked out of the outside world for the past 35 years. They know that such kind of statements will not bring a trickle of dollars into Iraq, because any businessman would think of the security situation. So it's before that, let's concentrate our efforts on this, on how to bring a state of law. If and only if security is established, a minimum of security. Iraqis are only asking for the basic things that any human being is asking for, and you will see their creative initiatives. They are asking for security and electricity. Is that too much for a human being to ask for in the 21st century?
Issam al-Khafaji is a former member of the U.S.-run Iraqi Reconstruction and Development Council and advisor to the Open Society Institute. He will be opening an Iraq Revenue Watch in Baghdad soon. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Arthur Kanoy, a prominent civil rights attorney and a founder of the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights, died late last week at the age of 82. Kanoy was involved in a number of high-profile cases, including the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and the defense of the Chicago Seven, who were charged with inciting riots at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. He was also known for representing witnesses called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s and 60s, and he was eventually called to testify himself. Those hearings and the era of radical anti-communism that was invoked by the likes of Senator Joe McCarthy have been on the minds of many civil rights activists lately. They're concerned that the USA Patriot Act and the climate of patriotic sentiments that enveloped the nation in the aftermath of September 11th have gradually led to a lessening of democratic freedoms traditionally protected under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. In the rest of today's program, we're going to hear from veteran political activist, free speech advocate, and Pacifica broadcaster Bill Mandel, who spoke with Peace Watch last week. Like attorney Arthur Kanoy, Mandel was called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. He says he remembers that day clearly.
Honorable beaters of children and sadists uniformed and in plain clothes, distinguished Dixiecrat wearing the clothing of a gentleman, eminent Republican who opposes an accommodation with the one country with which we must live at peace in order for us all and our children to survive. If you think that I am going to cooperate with this collection of Judases, of men who sit there in violation of the United States Constitution, if you think I will cooperate with you in any way, you are insane.
William Mandel, just hearing that, I just can't help but think of how brave and how bold you were. What are your thoughts as you listen to this over 40 years later?
Rather unusual, because for many years I was annoyed when I was automatically introduced as the man who bashed Iraq. Not because I wasn't proud of it, I am, but because I've spent my life doing many things, and the notion of attaching me to something that actually took 15 minutes, that was the length of that hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I find, because the years have passed, very recently, I find that I am being introduced out here in California, of course, as the man who was on KPFA for nearly 40 years. And so I find that I do want to remind people, especially in these years of the Patriot Act, of that entire period.
Indeed, you have such a rich life. You spent much of your life campaigning against war and nuclear weapons. So I did want to ask you about a recent development in that field, very recent. The U.S. Senate voted last night to reject a measure that would have halted the development of new types of small nuclear weapons, and it voted to allow the resumption of underground nuclear tests. How significant is this, in your opinion, and what type of effect will this have on the proliferation of nuclear weapons around the world?
The essence of the matter is this. I spent the better part of the last year trying to quell the hysteria caused by the general policies of the Bush administration and by the Patriot Act and, of course, by the attempt to introduce and pass an even worse version of it that would dot the I's and cross the T's. And I have been pleased by a number of Senate votes, of which this one last night was not one, a number of votes both in the Senate and the House indicating that these bodies are not going along automatically with the Bush policies as they seem to be doing earlier. That does not surprise me. I would say what we're witnessing right now is a struggle, whereas there was no struggle a few months ago. A struggle in which public opinion is making it quite clear. And in a number of votes, this included Republicans as well as Democrats, because Republicans control both houses. Every time a progressive measure is passed or a retrogressive measure is turned down, it means that a certain number of Republicans are voting with the majority of Democrats on such a thing.
Yes.
So my general reaction is pretty much as it was, to get back to your question to me, it's pretty much as it was not only to UAC, but to something in my life that was much more important and that is publicly forgotten simply because, number one, that many people are alive, and number two, the mood was not right for it.
Mm-hmm.
I was before UAC in 1960. I had been before Joe McCarthy in 1953. I will tell you very simply that standing up to Joe McCarthy in 1953 took a great deal more courage and skill than standing up to UAC in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is that by 1960, there was a change in public opinion, and the students were ready to move. It was my good fortune. It may be strange to use the word good fortune in such a connection. It was my good fortune to be called before UAC on the very day that, well, before a hearing in San Francisco with 5,000 students outside. This was the first important demonstration of white students in 20 years. Black students had started moving early the same year, and the white students' activities were to some degree influenced by the black students in the South earlier that year.
Mm-hmm.
So that the segments that you broadcast at the beginning of the show was at exactly the right time, and the reason it is still being heard 40 years after the event, and I can tell you it's been in 6 movies and goodness knows how many TV specials.
Mm.
The McCarthy hearing of 1953 was actually heard by a vastly larger audience. The UAC hearing became famous through movies, Operation Abolition and others. The McCarthy hearing was heard by literally the entire country. It was broadcast live. But at that time, I was virtually alone in the country, left, right, and center, in believing that the man could be defeated, in having enough faith in American democracy, and that is the essence of the issue then and today, having enough faith in the American people's faith in democracy to be certain that he would be turned around and defeated.
Mr. Mandel, some Americans have compared the Patriot Act climate of today and other legislation enacted in the aftermath of September 11th to laws in effect during the era of so-called McCarthyism. Do you see any parallels between the two times?
Not yet and not remotely. Whereas the Patriot Act today actually is worse than the McCarran Act, which was the legal formalization of McCarthyism, nonetheless, it has not nearly affected us as a people. I want to make one very important exception. It has had a terrible effect upon people from Near and Meas and Middle East, Arabs and Muslims in general. For them, one can make a direct comparison. Frankly, this will sound very strange, but in terms of American history as a whole, remember we had the Alien and Sedition Acts under our second president, Adams. We had Abraham Lincoln suspending habeas corpus for a period in pursuit of a good cause, but he suspended habeas corpus. We had the Red Scare after World War I and the Russian Revolution. The strangest thing is that this is today just about the freest period in American history, minus the last 2 years. We were a little bit freer before Bush came in. But in terms of the realities of today, strangely enough, this is not a bad time. The people in office want to make it worse. The job now, of course, is to stop them from doing so.
Mr. Mandel, you were a friend of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, who were, of course, executed by the U.S. for espionage. What impact did that experience have on your life at the time?
Okay, in the first place, I never met Ethelyn Julius Rosenberg. What happened was that there was a third defendant. His name escapes me. He is alive. He lives right here in the Bay Area now. He served 14 years on Alcatraz. I did not know him. I met him recently in San Francisco. But I did get to know his wife and his mother, wonderful people who put up a tremendous fight. By the way, let me say that I was called before McCarthy when the Rosenbergs were in the death house. This is 1 month before their execution. I was an ideal person for a similar frame-up because I was a Soviet affairs expert and had actually talked to real live Russians, which was very rare in those days in the Cold War. And the FBI had called up and left a message to my wife, quote, "If your husband does not cooperate, he'll be a defendant in a major case," close quote. At all events, the highlight was when the execution took place. We had a demonstration on just west of Union Square, 17th Street. We pretty much jammed the street between Union Square and Fifth Avenue. And when the executions were announced to the audience, there was a gasp of despair. And a friend of mine from Chicago, an African-American, it happens, who headed a committee called National Committee for the Protection of the Foreign Born, which was driven out of business by McCarthyism later, he turned to me and said, "Bill, we ought to head for the Lower East Side." It was exactly the right thing to do. I knew how to project, and I yelled, "We're heading for," I forgot the name of the housing development in which the Rosenbergs had lived, and we simply took over the streets. There were perhaps half a dozen mounted cops, but we were in no mood. This is the essence of that kind of demonstration. We were in no mood to be stopped by anybody. There was no violence. As I said, we simply overwhelmed the cops. We marched east on 14th Street, down 2nd Avenue, and a rather fascinating thing happened. At about 8th or 9th Street, some man who was aware of what we were doing quite literally tried to kill us. I was in the front row with my daughter, who was 13, and a German-Jewish American veteran of World War II, and a man who might have been a rabbi, judging by his beard, but I don't know. We were the front rank, and I'm walking with my 13-year-old daughter. This man comes along in a car and tried to back and forth, you know, push the car back and forth, quite literally trying to kill us. I took my daughter's hand and crossed 2nd Avenue and motioned to the crowd to follow, but they were having no part of it. They didn't turn the car over, but they stopped this. But from that point on, the police, by this time, police cars were paralleling us on 2nd Avenue, and police cars actually literally led the way. In short, warnings, news had clearly come down from police headquarters. This is not something we're going to try to stop. There's just too much tension here. This is one of three. I was a New Yorker for 35 years. I was born in New York City. It's one of either two or three demonstrations in my lifetime without a permit that the New York cops allowed. The first one is somewhat pertinent to all this. Way back in during the Great Depression, maybe 33, 34, a young black man named Angelo Herndon, he was 19, was arrested in Atlanta, Georgia, and sentenced to 20 years for insurrection for leading an integrated parade, Atlanta, Georgia, an integrated parade for what we now call welfare. People were starving. We actually got him out of jail by raising $20,000 bail, which in that case could have been $2 million. In those years, incomes were such, you gave a nickel, you gave a dime, you gave a quarter. And he got off at Penn Station, 34th, and we had a demonstration then. I guess I must have been 17 at that time, so it was 1934. We met get him there, and we put him on our shoulders, and we took over the streets and went down to 14th Street back then. That was the only other case I personally remember of the New York police being smart enough to figure this is a bit too hot to handle. At all of it, when the Rosenbergs were executed, we ended at Strauss Square in front of paper of the Jewish a newspaper, the Daily Forward, which had a poll, you know, a lot of the Jewish community took the attitude to go along, to get along, and would, and the government had very carefully, because the Rosenbergs were Jewish, the government very carefully had them prosecuted by a Jewish prosecutor, the same guy whom I faced before McCarthy. Roy Cohn was the prosecutor in the Rosenberg case. Roy Cohn was the man I faced in the McCarthy hearing. So that the government very carefully had the entire staff, which got the Rosenbergs executed, consisting of Jewish people. My daughter had gone around the last afternoon with a friend of hers. These 13-year-olds are their own initiative, to the homes of rabbis in Washington Heights, trying to get them to send telegrams to the president to listen to Professor Urey, U-R-E-Y, one of the great nuclear weapons experts, who said that this whole thing was impossible, that what the Rosenbergs were accused of doing was something impossible for any lay person to do, that it would take a highly technical individual to transmit this. And the rabbis, they had not been hostile to the children, but they made it very clear that it was just not safe for them to send telegrams of that kind. So that it was a different situation.
Bill Mandel is a veteran political activist, free speech advocate, and Pacifica broadcaster. We'll continue our conversation with him after a short break. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.